Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
March 15th, 2026, episode 294. They say, hello everyone, welcome into the corner, the Beekeeper's Corner. I am Kevin England. Today, as it turns out, seems to be a rather casual day. We're going out for a little bit of a brunch this morning with my son and his girlfriend to celebrate Sharon's birthday. Happy birthday, my dear. They say it's your birthday, and it. As this week progressed, I had a couple things on my mind, and while I sit here tonight on a Sunday evening, I wanted to bang out an episode and get those things on the airwaves. We've had a couple projects underway over the last couple weeks, and this weekend, in the week ahead, signals the end to some things that I've been working on that allow me to open the door for the next chapter of things I have scheduled to do. One of the things I've been looking forward to getting to is a little garage time. Getting to my honey-do list. That honey-do list is two-part, made up domestic chores and beekeeping activities. On the domestic side that bleeds over to the beekeeping side, we have a Craftsman lawn tractor that the left front wheel is pointing in some other direction other than straight ahead. The shaft is bent, and I'm going to have to figure out how to bend that thing back. Apparently, it's a common problem with them over the years. I know that that's a number one priority and one of Sharon's to-do lists for me to complete in spring. And actually, as it is, we use this lawn tractor quite a bit in the beekeeping operation, so I have to put that at the top of the pile. All of this to say, I'm sure as a beekeeper, you have your own list to maintain, and hopefully you're not procrastinating, and you've lined up, blocked out enough time to get to the tasks ahead. This time of year always makes me think about what I'm going to do in the bee yard and how can I improve from previous seasons. I think the longer you're at this, the more you consider process improvement as the seasons begin. You know, I was just having this conversation with somebody yesterday about the fact that I manage more bees in just about the same amount of time when I started because I'm a lot better at it. It didn't dawn on me that's true until we started in on that discussion line and I started to think about the efficiencies I've gained over the year. So to the point, I opened this show with a roundtable. One of my ideas for this year, and I called the roundtable the Art of the Possible, and just spoke about this at Bucks County, I'm considering using artificial intelligence to improve my record keeping. I'm going to tell you what I have in mind. Roundtable number two, I tried to get an answer to some of my open questions about the product Naroa at the Midwest Expo, but it didn't pan out, and I'll tell you why. Still on the chase for that one. Roundtable number three, someday we will have the equivalent of a Jetsons lifestyle in beekeeping, meaning the future will come and we'll be able to do some of the things that we wish we could do, like flying cars. That notion. You'll understand the context when I get there. Roundtable number four is about a review of a gadget that I saw in a video out of Brazil. It helps you sweep the bees off capped honeycomb that you're taking for honey processing. It's rather ingenious, I might add. In the back half of this episode, I'll bring you an update from the LIPA Hive Report. I had a chance to wander out the Valley Crest and check on those two beehives, and I'll tell you what I found. Also going to share some impressions of the week that just passed and what I think it should mean to beekeepers in this region, given the forecast for the next couple weeks. And then I'll close the show with some odds and ends. No muss, no fuss this week. Kevin at bkcorner.org is my email. Show notes are available at www.bkcorner.org. Please like and subscribe, write a comment about the show in your podcast player. That helps us out. And if you ever care to make a donation to the show in order to help me defray the costs which come out of our pockets here to produce the program, there's a donate button on the homepage. And I truly appreciate any help that comes our way, as everything that comes in gets put right back into producing the program. Bippity boop, here we go. Roundtable number one, record keeping in the modern age. To open the show, I wanted to call this one originally The Art of the Possible, because something for the modern age will sound so old-fashioned in the future. Art of the Possible. It echoes the sentiment of a presentation I gave this weekend at the Bucks County Beekeepers Symposium for record keeping and using technology for hive monitoring. I mentioned in the last show that this symposium was coming up, and it was a great turnout and also a great program. I had the privilege of opening the show, and I started with a talk that discussed the art of the possible in the context of the future, keeping track of what's going on inside your beehives. In the presentation, I mentioned that I'm quite familiar with the ways that beekeepers track information about their colonies. Starting with, actually, some people who have never written down a record in their entire beekeeping career. There are those of you who are out there. But on the whole, and I took a little survey, people employ notebooks, they take pictures, they make videos, they use hive inspection forms, employ electronic devices to track activities inside the hive. Some even, as we all know, write on the top of their beehives with markers. There's probably a couple that I'm forgetting, and it seems like, based on the survey, the most popular one was to keep a logbook. But I shared that the one that I've gravitated to is recording voice notes after each and every inspection. Now, if you've listened to this program for a while, you know that I have taken the time many years ago to create a hive inspection form, and even just recently, I posted the latest revision of that form to the website for the 2026 season. So it might seem interesting to note that I'm recording voice notes. And how does that have anything to do with the hive inspection forms? Therein lies the context of the presentation. Kevin Mummett. I have to share this, by the way. When it comes to analytics about this podcast, people might want to know, well, how many downloads do you have? How many listeners do you have? It's infuriating because you can never tell how many people listen to the show. You can get a sense of the downloads and the people who subscribe, but you can't tell because they subscribe to the show, but they may never actually listen to it. And so web metrics for podcasts is a difficult nut to crack. What's not difficult, however, for me personally, is what goes on at your own website, bkcorner.org, my website. Because from the dawn of time, you can always get web metrics. When you click on a web page, it registers a visitor. As it turns out, beyond the people accessing the pages for the show notes and listening to the episodes through the website, the two most visited pages on my website are, over the years, I have the records of this, people have been downloading the hive inspection form that we created, along with accessing the recipe for fondant. Far and away, the two most popular pages beyond the podcast episodes. Oh, and incidentally, I talk about fondant a little later in the program. End of Kevin moment. So net-net, I still do use my hive inspection form. And this was the jump-off point in the presentation this weekend to say that when I record my voice narration, I envision in my mind my hive inspection form, because I know I'm going to fill it out later, and read through the details in narrative form to follow the layout of the hive inspection form so that when I pull the form up on my computer, because I do it on my PC, it only takes me moments to translate the audio into a hive inspection record. Now, here's the interesting part to consider as we move into the modern age of the word we all know, artificial intelligence, AI. The software that I use to record the voice note can translate the audio into a transcript, lickety-split. So I recently did some testing for the 2026 season. I took the transcript and I fed it into Copilot AI along with the Hive inspection form. And the prompt I gave it, the instruction, was build me a report following the format of the form. And as it is, which is just mind-blowing, instantaneously gave me a written report of the exact format I would want, a written narrative. Now, I have to share, I'm a visual guy. In some respects, it's not as easy for me to read an even well-structured report, because I have to read it. And if you know how my form works, if you've ever seen it, it's very visual. It works with checkboxes. And you could scan the form without having to read anything to understand what the state was, because all the different things that are in the form have a checkbox next to it. And it makes it easy to fill out, no writing. Queen right? Yes, check the box. Queen seen? Yes, check the box. Number of boxes? 2. Check the box. That type of thing. And then as I scan, how many boxes? 2. It's easy. I know when people look at that form, they think it's extremely busy. It looks like one of those Scantron forms, if you remember from high school. Maybe I'm dating myself. But when you see it filled out, and I fill it out with a highlighter, it's astonishingly easy to grasp the information it's conveying. But here's the question, and I have to advance my process. In the age of AI, do I care? Do I really care whether I can read the form or not? Because if I can make AI take every one of my Hive inspection reports to date, say I'm 3/4 of the way through the 2026 season, and consolidate all the information that I can ask in a query, why do I care what it looks like? I just ask questions. Imagine, if you will, that I have 2 beehives, play pretend, and I've written my standard report all through the course of the summer, spring and summer, fed that into a single document that the AI can read from, and it can build the report that I just talked about. In my presentation, I had a picture of Hal from 2001, A Space Odyssey, and next to it was a number of questions. How? La 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 la. Like that movie, we're at the age where I could say, which beehive did I make a remark that I need to replace the frame that was broken? Well, Kevin, the answer is Lilila. The AI, using data that I supplied, would instantaneously tell me which hive it was and what frame would need to be replaced. And I could make my to-do list. I could ask the question, how old is the queen in Hive X? Because over the number of seasons, it's tracked all that stuff. The continuity of Hive records would eventually extrapolate some information that the AI can say, on this date, you installed a new queen, and since you're asking me that and you've given me no other information about replacing the queen, should be 2.5 years old, it could probably say to the day, you installed the queen 2 days and whatever number of hours ago. I could ask questions like, when's the last time I fed Hive B? And, well, you get the gist of it, right? There are some apps that are being developed as we speak in the marketplace for beekeeping record keeping. I know of one that I saw at the Midwest Expo that's going there that let you record voice notes and query back using some sort of AI engine. And this is where I get kind of melancholy, because unfortunately they probably require a subscription, and I'm past the days of wanting to sign up for any more subscriptions in my life. So all of this is to say, our world is going to change. The way we do things in the future will likely evolve. It's inevitable. And before you tell me that I'm not technical and I don't understand any of this AI stuff, I will remind you, to draw a comparison, that in the past, when we wanted to look things up pre-internet, we went to the library, or we sought out someone we can get an answer from.
And the internet has changed our life in a way we simply couldn't hop online back in those days at any given moment, find access to an answer by submitting a query. But everybody knows how to do that now. I Googled it. It's a verb. The tagline for the final was that, with the advancement of artificial intelligence, you will, I think, could be in the next few months, or could be in the next few years, be able to create your own personal assistant that's going to track your to-do items and your record keeping, any pertinent information you want to know about your beekeeping operation, as long as you get into a good practice, a good process to capture the notes properly in the first place, so that it has proper information to train the AI, meaning feed it the information that's correct from the source, you. And I'll come back to why I chose voice notes over all the other processes. I should say that I used to print out my forms and take them out in a clipboard and fill them out back when I first invented them back in 2016-17, even through to 2020. That is until they became a pain. I didn't want to print them. The printer was broken. The printer was out of ink. The forms got wet. I didn't bother to fill them out because I didn't have time. I forgot I was supposed to put this information in because I waited till the end and went back in the house to fill out the form because I was hot. And well, over time I've adapted the good discipline that as soon as I put a roof back on a hive, I step back, reflect on what I did, and I take the 2 minutes, 3 minutes it takes to create the voice note that's timely, accurate, in a proper format, and it articulates all the things that were pertinent to the inspection, including my next actions. And I do it almost in near real time, so the fidelity of it is amazing. Now, very soon the world is going to change once again because you'll be able to put a device on your body. Could do it today, actually, that will record everything that's going on, and you'll just be able to ask for it to summarize what occurred. Back in the day, I was great at writing meeting minutes for work items. You would never get anything past me because I would say, so-and-so said this in this meeting. There's new devices out there today, and there'll be plenty of them in the marketplace very soon. There's one called Bee, and yes, that's B-E-E. The Bee computer is one such example. These are going to explode in the marketplace in the next couple of months. The Bee computer is a wearable personal AI that records everything you do and then can subsequently summarize any different events you partook in. I was talking with so-and-so earlier in the day, and they mentioned a restaurant. What was the restaurant? It was blah, 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 blah. It's going to do that. Now, this is going to open a really interesting can of worms, because as you walk around, you're recorded on cameras, and you've come to accept that in life. Now you walk up to somebody who's wearing one of these things, and everything you say is going to get recorded on their device. This is going to be interesting, I think. These are eventually going to come to your Apple Watch. Other devices emerge in the marketplace. You could buy them beyond the Bee computer. And if something like this catches on, it's going to be commonplace. Everybody will have one. And before you say that's not possible, I had a discussion with somebody who I work with, who's a young man, who didn't quite have the history that I do. And I said to him, I remember having a conversation that everybody will walk around carrying a cell phone. And he looked at me like, of course. I said, but that's not the way it was. I did cell phones for a living, so I knew what the potential was. And when I made that prognostication back then, the person was like, no, there's no way everybody's going to have one. Well, we know how that turned out. Google, for example, Zoe said we'd have wearable glasses. I think this other thing is the gateway to that inevitability. If you go to Bee Computer, that's https://bee.computer,
That's the website address. You could see what this device looks like and how they work. There's a little video there.
And I have to say, I don't take credit for this. Kudos to Kurt and Steve, the people that operated the meeting from Bucks County, for showing the audience these devices. They both had one during the symposium, and Kurt was telling everybody of the capabilities that he was enjoying after wearing his for a period of time. I could go into how they work, the number of hours, how much they pay, and all that, but that's not relevant. So this is what I want your takeaway to be. This year, consider upping your game. If you start record keeping now, if you're not doing it well, that's a good place to go. And if you're record keeping already, then is there a better way to do it? At the start of a beekeeping season, there's no better time to explore your practices and answer those questions. And well, recording by audio is where I've gravitated to. Isn't that kind of cool, I have to say? I have to share something about this recording and all the ones to follow. I broke my chair this week. I broke it. I'm sitting in this squeaky, terrible 1960s version of an office chair for the moment. I'm sorry. I know all that noise is going through. I bought a new chair. It's sitting right here behind me. I'm going to assemble it. But I wanted to get this episode out, so forgive all the squeaks and creaks. It won't be there in the next episode. So I'm going to end this by saying thanks to Bucks County for having me for the day. Enjoyed the seminars, the talks, Etienne Tardif, Anya McGurk, all the other presenters, outstanding job. I like the presentation I made. If anybody was interested in having that presented for their bee club, kevin@bkcorner.org. I would love to give it again because I think it's such an interesting message in this time. Yeah, fun day. Great job, Bucks County. Outstanding work. Roundtable number 2, Noroa, swing and a miss. I had an action item when heading out to the Midwest Expo to look in on some questions that I had about Noroa. I'm sorry to report that the representatives from Noroa were not present at the Expo. It appears they had a conflict and planted stakes somewhere else that day. I did make it a point to stop in the Man Lake booth to inquire about the product, as they are the ones selling the product, and they were at the show, and I thought maybe I could try my hand with them. Through my conversation with the Man Lake representative at the booth, that's how I know where the Noroa representatives were that day, I tried my questions, but I didn't get very far. The representative suggested that for the non-label questions, which are the kind that I had, my words, it would be best if I actually talked to company representatives directly and had words with them. I didn't feel like there was really a value in pushing the issue, so I ceased my questions and I moved on. So the questions stay on the back burner, and I would imagine that I will encounter the rep somewhere in my travels, or when time affords, I will simply block a time to physically reach out to someone and ask them to get some answers for the program. I will share that I did have some sidebar conversations with beekeepers at the show. And beyond that, since then, learned that getting approval for the products of this kind requires a bit of navigation by the companies. One particular question that I have is it seems that when you use sugar solution to deliver a product, you have to be careful that the product doesn't venture into claims of anything that would move it into being a medicine since the bees are ingesting it. Which is an interesting angle as one has to open the question, does the product pass into varroa from feeding on the adults who've taken in the product? I don't plan to go down that rabbit hole of speculation on my own. I'll have to talk to product representatives and can ask them to explain that angle. I guess for now we'll have to follow up with the label and anything extraneous and wait for answers to bubble to the surface.
I'll keep my ear to the ground. And if others are asking probing questions like us, then I would suspect it's the normal progression of things that our answers will come to the forefront. I've been looking, watching, and I've heard odds and ends and watched a few more videos that are out there on the record. Specifically, I'm looking for ones that have company representatives in them making statements about how the product works. And to that point, I want to take a moment to thank Adam Miller for the share of an insightful video to watch. Much appreciated there, Adam. There's time to get answers, and I do wonder, actually, if my visit to the Chester County Beekeepers All-Day Symposium next weekend would provide an opportunity. We'll see what the future brings. And Adam, I'll add your questions that you sent about the product to the list. Roundtable number 3, flight paths. From point A to point B. I think we all learned that the most efficient path is directly from one point to the other. I must admit that there are times when standing in the bee yard, I ponder exactly where in the neighborhood are our bees going. I think a holy grail for an everyday beekeeper would be some sort of flight radar of our honeybees, so we could see where they go. I watch bees fly off and have seen some very interesting things, and it always serves as a curiosity. You know, some bees, they fly straight out of the entrance and then they perform a U-turn and go back overhead. Others fly out and then up and then away very high. And others, again, beeline right out of the front entrance to some place in a flat straight line like they were shot out of a gun. As a human, we are left wanting, however, because as soon as our bees are out of our focal range, we lose sight. And we're only left to imagine where they're heading and how they're getting there and how long it takes them to get there and when are they coming back. And it's always a fascinating thing to me then, as you might imagine, to see researchers who are doing work to tag bees in some way and track where they're going and more specifically how they get there. I have talked about studies such as this in the past, and I have to say that every time I see a piece about tracking honeybee flight, I peer in like a curious onlooker with the hopes that one day we normal, everyday beekeepers might have the tech required to do our own flight path tracking. There's a new paper out that tracked honeybees from a hive to a feeder across a field. It's been all over social media as of late. You probably have seen it. The images show a superimposed paths of honeybee flights. And the researchers analyze the flight path efficiency to see how good bees are making it from point A to point B, what decision processes they used. And as you might imagine, the bees are astonishingly good. The data is interesting, but I'm still stuck on how did they do it. Secretly, I hope in some way we could tag our bees and launch an inexpensive drone and follow them out of the apiary to map our personal space or have something like flight radar, where we pull up an app and we can watch the bees flying in real time. I went down the rabbit hole. I watched a video. It was 3 or 4 clicks away from the original source article following some trail. Some things lead you on a journey. And it eventually showed a person holding a tagged insect in his hand. I don't think it was a honeybee. It was something else they were testing. The view in the video was from a drone, and the camera underneath it was hovering about 30 feet above the subject. The sensor, which was mounted to the bottom of the drone, detected the tagged insects in his hand. And when he released whatever this insect was, the reflector on the insect showed on the camera on the drone as a white glowing dot. And you could see the insect fly away. You know, sci-fi enthusiasts of the 50s long to see flying cars. And this beekeeper, 50 years later, is jonesing to see honeybees tracked in flight at real time. Now, as to the study, they tracked the bees flying to a feeder placed in a cornfield. It was around 400 feet or 120-ish meters away. The study worked with a colony, one, that was placed in a beehive, situated behind a large tree in a hedgerow. What they tracked was how the bees analyzed the landscape and what route they chose to navigate around the obstructions to go out and also come back to the hive with the reward of food from the feeder.
What they noted by plotting the routes is bees could go to the right, or they could go to the left around the obstacle. In this case, as I said, it was a large tree in a hedgerow. And one of the routes was more efficient, while the other was close, but not as good. As they analyzed the data, they reported how many bees always took the same route, how many varied, and how they varied. And they uncovered strategies. For example, when the bee left the feeder, did it fly towards the tree that was blocking the hive? And then when they got around it, got to it, flew around it, or did they fly to the open spot alongside the tree directly, or perhaps through a gap that was purposely in the hedgerow alongside the tree that served as a landmark for the visual clue for getting back to the hive? In this particular analysis, they found that bees might employ multiple routes out to the feeder, but almost always take a single and precise route back from the feeder to the hive. Now, you could get lost for more than an hour if you did a deep dive on the data and representations of the flights they recorded. They show a superimposed flight path map in different colors of the bees, and they tracked it over the field from the drone camera. During the course of making comparisons, they contrasted honeybee behaviors with known data from ants and bumblebees and pigeons. The contrasts and comparisons teach you a little bit about the differences, and in themselves is fascinating. It reminds me of the novels by Daniel Suarez, where evildoers are using the automated insect drones to implement attacks, following the patterns of pheromones given off by weaver ants. That book, Kill Decision, is a great read, by the way. At the bottom of the study, unlike many studies of this type, they disclosed the details of how they did it, down to the brand of glue they used to affix the tracker to the bee. I'm astonished. You don't usually get that level of detail. This is the summarization of the process that followed. They would capture a bee, shave the hairs off the thorax, and glue on a queen marking plate affixed with a polystyrene ball coated in a retro-reflective 3M tape. And that's the key to this. Now, as the bee takes light, the drone, not a bee drone, a drone, captures the reflection off of that ball, locks onto the bee, and uses a fast lock tracking system to follow the bee. The reflection serves to steer the gimbal on the drone to maintain the reflector in field of view. Kevin, moment. This sort of reminds me of the face tracking technology that comes with gimbals these days. I could set up my new Insta 360 gimbal and have it follow me as I walk a complete circle. I think the technology comes from SLR cameras, where they have tracking that they can pick out an eye through the viewfinder and have it be in focus all the time. That kind of tracking. The AI tracking of the drone in this case is quite spectacular. And it only stands to reason that someone could figure out how to use a parallel approach to have a drone to follow something. As my father might have said back in the day, ain't technology amazing? End of Kevin moment. Now, the coolest thing in the whole report is watching the video labeled S3 in the paper. It shows a drone physically following a bee from the feeder over the cornfield, around the tree, and into the hive. And it's so cool. It's a wonder to behold. Superimposed over the normal video you see from a drone flying over the cornfield while following the bee is a close-up crop of the corn under the drone where you can see the bee. And they show a view from the camera with the reflection on the bee that the drone is following, kind of side by side. So you know it's following a bee. It's kind of like shooting a picture with a FLIR camera. You can pull up the FLIR version and you could pull up the actual photograph of whatever was in the image. Now look, it's only a 30-second video, but it shows how ingenious this tracking method is. And every time you see this kind of reporting, following the trajectory of the bees, it's summed up by a superficial coverage of the technology used. Unlike efforts in the past, though, this one spells out verbatim. And for those who have a mind to possibly give this a try, you get so many clues on how it's done. It makes the art of citizen science something more approachable when they share it. So kudos to the German researchers for the disclosure. And it should be said that props are also due to Volkswagen for signing on as a sponsor of this research. Now, before I get too excited, I need to temper enthusiasm with the notion that the key to the solution, beyond tagging bees, beyond the drone required, and the other tech to the software for tracking, of all the elements that is the most likely, impressive part of the kit, you know? I guess I could dream of it, kind of like my version of popular science. I should mention that my twin has a drone, so I have that going for me, but I don't know. It's pretty ambitious to want to go off and try this on your own. In the end, they found out that the bees did fly directly to the tree on the side. They didn't fly at the tree and then fly around it. They figured out that that's a waste of time. There's a lot of other insightful conclusions about what they learned. Most of the bees figured out the most efficient way and then stuck with it on the flight back. They didn't alter from it. If they tried one way and then tried the other way and they knew way B was faster than way A, they always used way B on the second time. Some of the bees got tried and true to the gap in the hedgerow, and that was their go-to. So there were outliers. That wasn't the most efficient way. But in the end, the aggregate data showed that most of the bees coming back from the feeder going directly to the hive found the most efficient path based on scientific analysis, point A to point B, and it shows once again that our bees are so freaking smart. I will, of course, have links to the research and do spend some time looking at the data collected. And click on the video there. The disclosure from this group on what they did, how they analyzed it, access to the data, exemplary. Simply one of the best I have ever seen, and I've read a lot of research paper in my times doing this show. You could tell what brand of glue and how they used it to glue the sensor to the bee. That's how detailed they got, and I think that's really cool. The research paper is Precise Individualized Foraging Flights in Honeybees Revealed by Multicopter Drone-Based Tracking. Point A to point B, it's the way to go. Roundtable number 4, I call this one Clean Sweep. An Instagram video showed up this past week with an invention that someone created to clean bees off of a frame while harvesting honey. The gadget is a device that employs using a honeybee brush, or to be more specific, a number of honeybee brushes mounted to a box. And the premise is you take your honeybee frame, sweep it through the hairs of the brush in order to take off any errant honeybees. It appears that, and this is speculation on my part, that they probably cleared the bees with a fume board or something else, because the frames being passed through the gadget seem to have very few honeybees on the face of the cappings. The way that the beekeeper operated it, based on what you could see in the video, is they're pulling a frame out of a honey super, they're sweeping it through this contraption, and then they're placing the cleaned off frames in a spare box set to the side. In one motion, they pull the frame up out of the source box, sweep it through the gadget and maybe back and forth a couple times to ensure all the bees are dislodged, and then they turn and put it down in the other box, moving efficiently frame by frame. To picture the gadget, well, it's a touch hard to describe, but I'll take a shot at it. On one side, there are four wooden stakes spaced evenly apart, about 12, 18 inches long from what I could see. And they're screwed to a sheet of wood applied to them. The stakes appear to be something like 2-inch by 2-inch piece of wood, best I can tell. And on the two stakes spaced through the middle of the board, there's something similar, from what I can tell, to a bee brush mounted on its spine so that the bristles face out from the board at a 90-degree angle. On the opposite side of this board, which is set in a frame, is the exact same thing, but facing 180 degrees in rotation. And if you picture it, the bristles on the second board are across from the first board, and they almost touch the bristle tips from one board to the other. Now in operation, the beekeeper places the frame down in between the two walls, if you want to call it that, in the trough that's created between the two walls, and they drag the frame left through the bristles and then right through the bristles and back and forth until all the bees are cleared off in a swinging motion. Then they do what I said, which is put it in a box free of bees. Now I have to say, on first blush, hopefully you understood what that looked like, it seems pretty clever to me. You see, my lovely wife does not care to see any honeybees in the honey supers that I bring into the garage when we do our extracting. And I have, in the past, used a fume board and then a blower, an electric leaf blower, to blow out errant bees, but you know, it still doesn't work. There's typically a bunch of stragglers that hang on, even with the strongest blower. Because she wants no bees, no being the operative word, I usually take the extra step to draw out each frame after blowing individually and use a proper bee brush to flick the bees off and put that in the separate box. But that's just me being me and ensuring that my lovely wife gets what she wants. And actually, I'm being a bit cheeky. I'm not placing that on her. The real answer is, I don't like bees flying around inside the garage while we're harvesting. I don't like it. You know, sometimes if you don't pay attention to getting the bees out of the box, and even when you do pay attention, you'll have dozens of bees sitting at the windows inside the garage trying to get out, and a good number of them perish. And while I know this is probably a rounding error to the population of honeybees from all the hives that we harvested from, I still think every bee counts. And so I try to do my best to get all of the bees out. And well, if it makes Sharon happy, it's all the better. So I think it's kind of ingenious, except for one flaw in the design, the process. When you use a bee brush, you're not supposed to swipe at the bees like you're brushing the floor. You're supposed to flick the bees off, especially if it's not capped and the cells are open, because the bee could be head down in there, and while you're sweeping it across, you're crushing them down through the edge of the cell. When you sweep the bees off using his sweeping motion, you kind of press against them, against the face of the capped wax, and you could potentially damage the bees. Now that being said, let me not be hypocritical, blowing them out of the box and making them bang off everything on their exit is also really damaging to the bees. It's probably second to shaking bees in a sugar shake, which is known to kill the bees too. Yes, sugar shakes kill bees. They may live and they may be powder coated, but when you put them back in the hive, they eventually die from the trauma of that. That's a new study that came out recently. And so I don't particularly love blowing bees out of a box. I think it's a little too harsh for them. If I had my druthers, I would just fume board them and then pull the frame out, flick the bees off, which is actually what I typically do, unless I'm in a hurry or for whatever reason in my setup I decided for more efficient reasons I needed to blow the bees out. That's one of those in-the-moment decisions on how I proceed through the process. So coming back to center, the only knock I see is the brushing part. But honestly, I don't think that's that bad of an idea because as he moves it through, he's kind of flicking it very quickly through the brush. He's not sweeping it. He moved a rather aggressive method as he went through. So who knows? Might have to rig one of these this summer. Give it a try. I would want to know, as you brush the bees through this device, do the bees that get swept off appear to be harmed in any way by it? And if not, then heck, this is pretty cool. Now, this particular video, I think, based on all the tag and information, comes out of Brazil. It's out of Facebook. I don't know if it's open to the public. It has Brazil captions. Can't even read it and understand the language. But you get the gist of it when you watch the video. So I'll do what I can to provide a link to it. And if it's open, you can probably take a peek at it. Swing and a miss, or super clever idea? Hopefully you understood what I explained and might want to give that a thought. Pretty interesting. Time for the back of the book, Local Hop Report. This episode I wanted to talk about this week's activities. I went and fed fondant round 2 to a bunch of the colonies. I also had a chance to run out to Valley Crest to check on those 2 hives. And not to bury the lead, one made it through, one did not. I did not have the chance because I was heading to work and just stopped off to do something there and check and throw some fondant on. And I'm not sure why that hive didn't make it through. I'll do a necropsy somewhere along the line. But in earnest, when there's 2 hives sitting side by side, one makes it through and the other doesn't, I'm pretty sure that come springtime when the weather breaks, I'll just do a walkaway split. Because the other one was gigantic. The one that survived is loaded with bees, and it looks like a great candidate to split in half to keep it from swarming in the first place. Now, at the risk of being redundant, I wanted to mention this from my observations this week. I did look at a couple of my hives and continue to place fondant on some of those that are light. I've said this before, and I want to not belabor the point. I think a lot of bees went into winter light this year. The year that we had leading up to winter, bees ate a lot of the food that you gave them. And even if they stored it, because of some of the warmer weather we've had here in early spring, they've been active. And especially some of the larger colonies are going to eat down their food stores pretty quickly. I saw hives that I know were in decent shape, are a little light, not in danger, but a little light, and so I'm throwing fondant on them. I want to make sure that I didn't get this far and not make it to the finish line. If I look at the weather, given the fact that the crocus, the snowdrops, and other things emerged this week, I would think we're in a great place. However, it's going to turn cold again based on what the forecasts look like. We're going to have highs in the low 40s, with temperatures at night in the 20s and the 30s, which is pretty typical. You get a very roller coaster weather pattern through the middle of March to the end until the weather finally breaks and some of the plants, early plants, break and the trees go in April here in the Mid-Atlantic region, for example. So go out and check your bees. There'll be a couple warm days here or there where you can crack the cover and make sure you have enough food. Now, to that point, earlier in the episode, I had mentioned that I made some fondant. And I just recently talked about this on the show and had said the last time that I was going to try and tweak the recipe and see how it turned out. I did. I tweaked the recipe. I went and heated the fondant up to 245 degrees before I let it cool down. And then I let it cool down to 120 degrees and put it in the stand mixer and mixed it for 30 minutes. And it turned out really well. It was soft, white bulb, light white. Fudgy, little sticky, as you would imagine, but stiff enough that if you keep it cool, it doesn't run all over the place. Now, if you leave it to sit in a warm room, it will ooze, which is okay. Because actually, what I wanted to do is feed some nucleus colonies that don't have a lot of space on the top. And so I let it sit to the point where it thinned itself out a little bit, and then put it on aluminum foil and stuck it in the hive. And it was really thin, but it provided a large swath of food for them to have. That being said, the tweak to the recipe was so successful that I went and updated the fondant recipe on the website. I changed some of the notes, changed some of the temperatures, and some of the instruction, because I think the fondant I made this time was even better than the stuff that I've made in the past. I did one experiment which was interesting. I heated the fondant up, the sugar solution, up to the specific temperature, and then I let it cool down and I poured one part of it, one quarter, out onto a pan. I wanted to see what would happen if you didn't give it the whirl in the mixer. It's a little stiffer. It's almost like a crumbly sugar brick style, but it's soft and pliable. If you stick your finger down, it'll push all the crystal sugar apart, but yet it's gooey enough that it holds together, where the other stuff is soft and fudgy like you'd want a fondant to be. So I don't know, it almost serves to me to say that you could heat it up to the target temperature and bring it down and pour it into a pan and maybe forego the second part of the operation, which is typically to mix it in a stand mixer. That being said, I think the fondant came out really better. I like the texture of it better. I might even consider making it a little bit stiffer and cooking it to a higher temperature so that, well, I don't know. That's just a art of the possible for the next time. So who knows? We'll look to see what's going to happen over the next couple days. I will say that I have a date circled on the calendar to go talk to Bob Kloss and look at his bees and see what he's got going on. He's out of commission. It's been too cold. I haven't been able to check his stuff. He's got some stuff at his home. He's got some stuff at Valley Crest, where we have an outyard, and another location. And talked to him today, actually, about going out and doing a check on his bees and getting some of his dead outs cleaned up and things like that. So, yeah, spring is coming super quick. And I have to make a plan on, with all these hives, what am I going to do for my honey supers and how that's going to work. One other thing I wanted to report. I put a lot of fondant on the Waré hive. Still going. Wow. And I am positive, where I didn't inspect it, that my Lance hive made it through. The Lance hive is alive. I saw pollen going in the door, and I saw a massive amount of foraging going on. So I've lost 5 hives out of, let me see if I can do the math in my head real quick, 24, 25 hives, something like that so far. That's a ratio I can live with. I'm okay with that. Well, one thing I also wanted to share, observation this week, was that the bees were looking for water. Sharon was working out in the garden this week. She had a couple of warm days. It was 70-something degrees. She went and cleaned things up, and she brought a planter, plastic planter thing, and left it on the table out back, upside down. And water from rain collected in the lip of it. The bees went gaga over the water. They drank it all down, and I actually poured more water into it. And I noticed that they were everywhere water could be. They need water this time of year to dilute the sugar, and the water bottle bees were just going crazy. It makes me say to you that if you have a mind for this, early in the season, in these warm days, whatever your water source is going to be that you're going to establish in your yard, get it out early so the bees find it. It's not too early, even now,
to put water sources out so that the bees will have something to find. I'm positive when we move those containers off of the table that on the first warm day, there'll be bees back in that spot to come back and see if they can get some more water. And we made sure that we filled our water sources the other day, including some bird baths and things that we know that the bees use around our property. I have a mental note to come back to this. I wanted to come back to the one thing they did, which was interesting, and say, I'm pretty sure I'm going to repeat it this year. If you listened to the show last summer, I did something unorthodox where I went and pulled all of the brood, capped brood, brood in progress, out of the operational hives at the height of summer, peak population, where the varroa mites would have been highest, and I consolidated it, no queens of course, into a single box and let it all emerge, and then I treated it with Formic Pro. And looking back and trying to reflect, well, how did I get so lucky with getting all my hives through? I'm wondering how much that played a role. Because I took the varroa mites that were in the cappings in all those hives, yes, all the hives, and consolidated in one place. And then whatever those bees had for the rest of the season when they made new bees, they didn't have the varroa mite infestation that would have emerged from the frame after frame after frame of capped brood that I've removed. I have no evidence that that's the reason that my ratio of hive survival is a little bit better, but I could promise you I'm going to do it again next year and see if the pattern repeats. And it stands to reason that that was actually a pretty good tactical move. And if I do that 3 or 4 seasons in a row and I keep having a good result with it, then who knows, maybe that's the way to go. It's a different form of like integrated pest management. But instead of stopping the queen from laying, you just steal all the varroa mites out of all the hives. Yeah, an interesting strategy. Maybe I'm onto something there. And kudos to the researcher, I think he was from Germany, who planted the seed for that. Local hive report, check. Yeah, I think I'm going to end it here. I have a boatload of things going on lately. Just over the top every moment. This weekend brings to close the Boston Area Beekeepers beginner course that I've been teaching over the last number of Wednesday nights, so that's going to free up a night for me. Incidentally, if anybody needs a beginner's beekeeper course to be taught through Zoom, give me a shout, kevin@bkcorner.org. I think what we put together is tested. This is the second time I've done it for the city of Boston. I'm getting great feedback from it and would love to be able to parlay that into some additional opportunities to teach new beekeepers. Manage Mentoring, going strong. This week is a 2nd March meeting. Good attendance for the first one. Looking forward to the question and the community of new beekeepers coming into the program. We continue to get more and more registrations every week. ManagedMentoring.com is the web address. If you're a new beekeeper, you can go there, sign up for free, look at the year one lessons, go back and fulfill anything you need to know about painting your hives, buying bees, getting your hive set up, adhering to local regulations. Make sure that you registered your bees. If that's a requirement in your state, it is in New Jersey, and I just did mine because I forgot. Oops, sorry, but now I'm good doobie and taking care of that. And go to a bee meeting. Great time of year. There's a lot of them out there. The Westchester seminar is coming up. Signed up for that. I'm locked. The 28th is the date on that. And there's a lot of good stuff out there for you as a new beekeeper to learn, or even as a seasoned beekeeper. Got some messages this week about Kentucky EAS in July. You want to put that on your calendar? That's going to be an outstanding show. I'm going to do a number of talks there. I got the list of things they tapped me on the shoulder for, including leading the Friday path for technology, gadgets, and things very similar to the conversation we had at the opening of the show about using technology and AI and such. So looking forward to that. There's a lot of work to get down to get that sorted out. I had mentioned somewhere along the line that we were contemplating doing a queen rearing course, first one for our local beekeepers association. Locked in the location to do that last week, working on putting that program together. So no rest for the weary. There's plenty of beekeeping activity. And yeah, by the way, spackle, spackle, spackle. That's where I am in the family room world of taping and spackling all the sheetrock and getting ready to paint next week. So it's been a fun period lately. Holy cow. I said I was busy. It's been, and racing season starts. That's enough of that. It's late. I'm rambling. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we can accomplish great things. Thanks for checking in on the show. Looking forward to the next one. We'll see you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner.